On May 24, 2004, co-workers of 53-year-old Oki Albert Kite Jr., who went by Al, drove to his house to check on him after he failed to show up to work, something he had never done before. Inside his Aurora, Colorado townhome, officers discovered a horrific scene. Al had been bound, tortured for hours, and killed in his own basement. The killer cleaned up, removed key evidence, and disappeared, leaving behind only a small amount of DNA and a trail that pointed to a man who wasn't who he claimed to be. More than 20 years later, Al's murder remains unsolved, and detectives are still working to identify the murderer. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So the murder investigation of Al Kite Jr. is an interesting one, and I'm not the first person to cover it. In fact, it's been featured on multiple television shows. And I think one of the main reasons for that is obviously the case is horrific, but it comes down to the killer. Just based on what we've covered on this show, I'm not going out on a limb here. I have to tell you that the killer that we're trying to identify in this case may be one of the most dangerous people we've ever talked about. And the fact that he could still be out there somewhere is extremely alarming. All murderers being out on the loose is a bad thing. But when we talk about the specifics of this case and how this person planned for this murder and what they did to clean up after themselves, I think you're going to agree with me. We definitely have a lot to cover. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Oki Albert Kite Jr., who went by Al, was born on May 7th, 1951 in North Carolina, where he grew up with his sister Barbara. At some point, he moved to Aurora, Colorado, and people who knew him all said the same thing. He was a genuinely nice guy. Always happy, laughing, and smiling. By May 2004, Al was divorced and living alone in his townhome, which was located at 2002 South Helena Street in Aurora, just outside of Denver. He had also recently started dating a woman named Linda, and from everything we know, they were both really excited about the relationship. Al had worked as an accountant for more than 3 decades, and he was well liked at work. He was also known for being extremely punctual. So when Al didn't show up for work on Monday, May 24th, that immediately stood out. So his coworkers went to his house to check on him, and when they got there, his gray and blue 1983 GMC Sierra pickup truck wasn't there, and no one answered the door. They also spoke with neighbors, but no one had seen him since Saturday, May 22nd. At that point, they called in a welfare check, and when officers arrived, they found that the front door was locked, the garage door was locked, and all the windows were secure. There were no obvious signs of forced entry, so they had to force their way inside. Upstairs, everything looked normal. Al was known to be very neat, and nothing appeared to be out of place, except for one thing: the kitchen sink, which had been filled with bleach. Sitting in the bleach were several kitchen knives that belonged to Al, along with a drinking glass and a set of keys. There was also a honing rod, which was typically used to realign the blades of knives. And although that was odd, things would only get more concerning when officers went to the finished basement, which had a living room, a bedroom, and a bathroom. At first glance, everything looked okay. But when they went into the bedroom, they were met with a horrific scene. Al was found inside, and there was blood everywhere, on the floors, on the walls, even the ceiling. It was clear that he had been murdered and had been dead for at least a day. According to investigators, Al was found fully clothed, lying face down on the floor with his feet slightly under the bed frame. Additionally, his head and upper torso were covered by a small blue bath mat. When the bath mat was eventually moved, it became clear just how brutal the attack had been. His face was bruised and covered with injuries that extended down to his neck and shoulders. He had a large laceration on the back of his head, and his throat had been cut so deeply that it looked like he was almost decapitated. Prior to his death, Al had been tied up and tortured. The bindings themselves were gone, but the marks left behind told investigators what they needed to know. The lead detective later told Denver 7 that Al's hands had been elaborately tied to his ankles with rope. He was also bound around the upper arm, above the elbow, and twice above the knee. The rope had been wrapped multiple times in different cross patterns, and experts later estimated that it would have taken over 40 feet of rope to do this. The bottoms of Al's feet were also exposed, and they were covered in wounds and bruises. There were also bruises throughout his body showing he had been beaten with multiple blunt objects. An autopsy later showed that he had 11 stab wounds in total, above the eyeballs, into his eardrums, down through his shoulders, and across his upper torso. And in addition to those injuries, he also had that deep cut to his throat that I discussed earlier. Now, the worst part of all of this is that they were able to determine that none of the stab wounds or the blunt force injuries appeared to be fatal, and based on the evidence, it was clear that these had been inflicted for hours before the final cut to his throat ultimately killed him. And so as you can see, this is a horrific scene. And if you're watching on YouTube, then you've already seen some of the images from the crime scene, including the sink that's full of bleach with the knives, the glass, and the keys. And there's a few things that we can deduce from what we have here, what we've talked about so far. First off, the entire crime appears to be isolated to this bedroom located in the basement, and that will become very important later in the story. But you have to ask yourself, how did they get down there? What occurred? And there's a few theories you can go through as you're trying to hypothesize what happened here. But the most likely scenario is that whoever was at the home, more than likely, because there's no signs of forced entry, Al knew this person. He felt comfortable with them, enough to at least let them inside. And then you would have to ask the question, well, why would they go to the basement? Because it doesn't appear that there was any struggle on the main floor. So technically, you can assume that Al went voluntarily. Now, on one hand, you could argue that he maybe went because he was being held at knife point. On the other hand, you could make a very strong argument that he went down to that basement because he and this other person had business down there. And again, this will become a critical part of the story when we talk about the potential suspect. Now, as far as the actual injuries to Al, there's two ways you can go with this. On one hand, you could say this is just a sadistic monster who got off on torture, and that's where their gratification came from, torturing Al for hours before ultimately killing him. On the other hand, again, as we talk about more things, this could have been very calculated and in fact been done to extract certain information. So I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but there's certain things that you can take from this crime scene that may give us some insight into who our killer is. Speaking of the killer, when it comes to the crime scene itself and what they did to avoid detection and apprehension, on one hand, you could say this is definitely a professional. This isn't the first time that they've killed someone, and clearly they felt comfortable being around a dead body. On the other hand, you could say it's just someone who's fascinated by murder and had been thinking about this for a long time and took a lot of measures to prepare, watching documentaries and movies and TV and reviewing other cases to determine what was the best course of action to take to give them the highest likelihood of not being caught. So I don't like to go down one track and as a profiler would and say, yes, this is definitely someone who's killed multiple people in the past and that's why they knew what to do after the crime. I can see where they're coming from. And if you made me choose, I would definitely lean in that direction. There have been many instances in the past. Take, for example, Brian Koberger, where it's an intelligent guy. He's well-planned. He thinks he's thought of everything. And there were multiple missteps in those murders that led to his apprehension. So if this is someone who is doing it for the first time, regardless of what they did to try to prevent them from being caught, more than likely they're going to make a mistake and we're going to be able to capitalize on that. But here, one of two things, either they got extremely lucky or they knew exactly what they were doing. And although the suspect did a good job of cleaning up the crime scene, there were assumptions that could be made based on observations. After the officers found Al, detectives and crime scene investigators were called to the scene. And based on what they were seeing, it was clear the killer had been very careful about where the violence occurred. There was no obvious blood anywhere outside the basement bedroom. And as I just mentioned, the killer took the time to clean up. The bindings were removed, the knives used to stab Al were placed in bleach in the kitchen sink, and the entire crime scene was wiped down. The killer even took the trash with them, which included the bottle of bleach. And here's the craziest part. The killer also showered inside the home, taking the bath towels with them. And along with those towels, they also took one of Al's shirts and a pair of his pants. And on their way out, they took Al's truck, his phone, and his wallet. So this is a little contradictory, right? If this is a trained killer, you would think they wouldn't want anything connecting them to the body. On the other hand, the fact that they were willing to stay in the home after killing Al and they felt that comfortable there shows a level of planning and a comfort being around dead bodies, as I mentioned earlier. But then on the way out, they wear their victim's clothing. They take his truck, his phone, his wallet. That could link them back to the murder. But here's the way I look at it, and it's a morbid way of thinking about it. You have to imagine that unless the suspect brought a second set of clothing, based on the crime scene, they were absolutely covered in blood. So what's more of a risk? Leaving the house in your own clothing, covered head to toe in blood, or wearing your victim's clothing for a short period of time and dumping them as soon as you can? I'm going to go with the latter because most people aren't going to see and go, wait, that's my buddy Al's t-shirt, unless it's like a specific shirt. So clearly this might not have been the plan. In fact, I would argue that it wasn't. Why would you want to shower in this place where your DNA could potentially be flushed down the drain? And yet it was a necessary risk because they knew based on the circumstances of the murder itself, they had no choice being covered in blood. And investigators spent more than a week in the house trying to find a shred of evidence they could tie to the perpetrator. And they got lucky. There was a single drop of blood on the stairs leading down to the basement. And that stood out because there was no blood anywhere else in the home outside of the bedroom. And detectives believed it could belong to the killer, possibly from an injury during the attack. That blood was collected and entered into CODIS, the FBI's combined DNA index system. But so far, there have been no matches. However, that DNA will come back up later in this story. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Cravings aren't just about nicotine. They're about habit. That hand-to-mouth motion, oral fixation, the momentary pause. When that loop is broken, cravings spike, and Fume replaces your habit with a flavored air fidget device that gives your hands and mouth something to do, distracting cravings without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. So don't just try to quit. Upgrade that habit loop and reach for a Fume instead. You guys have definitely heard me talk about Fume before. It's a flavored air device designed to help people quit smoking or vaping by breaking that hand-to-mouth pattern. And as I mentioned earlier, no nicotine, no batteries, no vapor, just clean natural flavors and a fidget-friendly design that actually feels good to use. And I've talked about the Fume before. I love the design. It matches my desk, if you can see here. Real wood, real metal, solid design. And I'm someone who is constantly playing with something. If you're watching the episode, you got the magnets. That's probably my favorite. You also have the twist, the clicks. I don't do the clicks as much. I like the magnet, but it feels good. It's weighted. You can tell it's not cheap. And as far as the flavors, orange, vanilla, that's my personal favorite, but I also really like raspberry as well. And we all know how it goes, right? When you're trying to do something new, day one feels easy, right? But then by day five, your brain starts negotiating with yourself. And before you know it, you're back to doing what you used to be doing. And nobody wants that. But Fume will help you replace that motion and that routine without falling back into that old pattern. So if you're thinking about trying Fume, now would be a great time to do so because I got a great deal for you. When you grab a journey pack, you're also going to get a free gift just for using my code DETECTIVE. And Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits. And now it's your turn. So use my code DETECTIVE to get your free gift with your journey pack. All you have to do is head over to tryfume.com. That's TRYFUM.com. Once again, tryfume.com and use my code DETECTIVE to claim your free gift today. All right, we're back from break, and I was talking about the DNA that was found, but there was also one other thing located by investigators. A small piece of rope left behind on the carpet near Al's body. Investigators found no evidence that Al owned the rope, so they believed it belonged to the killer and had simply missed it during his cleanup. So investigators remained at the scene processing anything that they could find, and while they were doing that, officers were out searching for Al's missing belongings. According to the Denver Post, Al's truck was found a few blocks away from his home in the 15300 block of East Evans Avenue. And if I'm saying that wrong, it's 15300. I'm sure there's someone from that area who's going to be like, oh, it's not 15300, but that's just how it rolled off the tongue to me. I apologize if I got that wrong, but overall, 15300 block. Inside of Al's truck, there were a few strands of medium-toned brown hair. They were collected and sent off for testing, but I don't know if they ended up coming back to the killer or if they were a nothing burger and law enforcement just hasn't disclosed that information to keep the killer on their toes. Overall, there has been no further details about these hairs. It could go one way or another. The one thing I would say, if we believe that there's one suspect, one killer, then even with the blood results not coming back to anyone, you would expect the blood to match the hair and that they would belong to the same person if it was in fact the killer. Again, this is information that investigators would have that they haven't disclosed publicly, and I can understand why. Al's phone was later recovered from a payphone booth at a Safeway grocery store in Denver, but by that point, it had been handled by multiple people, and no useful evidence was recovered. It's unclear if detectives ever found Al's wallet. What we do know is that they learned his debit card had been used at a nearby Wells Fargo ATM at 9:59 p.m., on May 22nd. And I'm sure a lot of you are lighting up right now going, oh my God, I hope that they went to that Wells Fargo because more than likely there was a camera at that ATM. And if you're one of those people, you're right. There was a camera there and investigators did go to that location. And when they got the footage, they saw a man wearing a ski mask and gloves and he was driving Al's truck. And he even used Al's PIN to withdraw the $1,000 from his account. And so what do we take from that? Well, we know that Al was tortured. And during that torture, he may have been asked a question about his PIN. And I can only imagine that he wouldn't have put up much of a fight and gave the suspect the PIN as soon as he asked, right? That would have been one of the questions. Do I think that was the sole reason for the torture? Absolutely not. I don't believe that this killing was motivated by a robbery, was financial in nature. I don't believe that. It may have been a part of it, but to me, this represents a killer needing a small amount of money to go on to the next location, to escape and get out of there without being detected. Hence the reason why he's withdrawing the cash from the ATM and not using the debit card along the way. That's going to leave a paper trail, a digital trail that investigators can follow. But by grabbing the cash, yes, he's going to be on camera, and I'm sure he knows that, which is why he's wearing the mask and gloves. But he's thinking, hey, this is the only shot they're going to get, and then I'm going to disappear. And that's exactly what he did. And for those of you watching on YouTube right now, you're seeing the footage of the suspect at the ATM. If you're on audio, I strongly recommend you mark the timestamp, come over and check it out. It is pretty chilling when you think about what transpired only a few hours prior to this. Again, it shows a level of preparation. My belief is that Al's killer went into his house under a false pretense. I believe he was invited in, so he wouldn't have been wearing a mask at that time. But clearly, he had the forethought to bring the mask for one reason or another. And obviously, part of that was to hide his identity after the fact by wearing the mask and gloves. So again, we're seeing a very sophisticated murder here where there are multiple steps that were planned out ahead of time to increase his odds of not being caught. This doesn't sound like a novice. This wasn't someone who, during a crime of passion, decided to kill Al and then was scrambling afterward. This person went to Al's house knowing exactly what they were going to do. Now, at this point, with this new information and this new footage, detectives knew that Al had likely been killed prior to 9:59 p.m. on May 22nd, but they needed a more accurate timeline, so they conducted interviews with the people who knew Al the best. And what they learned is that no one had seen or heard from him after 3:30 p.m. on the 22nd. That morning, Al took his girlfriend Linda to the airport, and according to Oxygen, he then met up with his best friend Mike in Denver, where the two were working on a remodeling project. And at some point, Linda called Al during a layover, and everything seemed normal. He was upbeat, just like usual. By around 2 or 3 p.m., Al and Mike had wrapped up for the day, and the plan was to go home, clean up, and then go out that night, but Mike never heard from Al again. So that was between 2 and 3 p.m. when Al and Mike wrapped up, and then Linda called Al again at 3:30 p.m. And during that call, she noticed something was off. She said Al was very quiet, which was completely out of character for him. And after that call, she never heard from him again. And as far as investigators could determine, no one saw or heard from Al after that phone call. Neighbors reported seeing him earlier in the day, but nothing after. And no one reported hearing anything suspicious, even though the townhomes shared walls. One neighbor told Oxygen that the walls weren't thin, so it wouldn't be unusual not to hear anything. Now, detectives doing their job decided to test this theory out, so one detective went down into the basement bedroom and screamed as loud as he could, and no one in the surrounding units or outside could hear him, so it looks like that holds up. This may be a case where the murderer just got lucky, or you have to ask yourself, because of some prior knowledge, were they aware that these walls were thick, and if it were to happen in the basement, that would be the best place because more than likely, it wouldn't raise any attention. But overall, based on what they had been able to gather from witness testimony and talking to neighbors, this information led them to believe that whatever happened to Al happened between 3:30 p.m. and 9:59 p.m. on May 22nd. The only thing I would add in there, just a little bit of a caveat, is that, yes, that could be the time frame in which most of it went down, but there's still a possibility somehow, even though there's no forced entry, that the suspect was already inside the house prior to 3:30 when Al got home. Now, is that what I think happened? No. I think it's more likely, like I have said multiple times, that after Al got home, the suspect showed up, and for whatever reason, he let him inside. And we're going to talk about that because there is a very probable theory as far as why the suspect would have been let in. When detectives spoke with Al's loved ones, they asked the obvious question: was there anyone who would want to hurt him? And across the board, the answer was no. No one could make sense of this. Al was well-liked and, by all accounts, a genuinely good person. But there was one person Linda thought needed to be looked into further: Al's new roommate. And that's right, I haven't mentioned this person up to this point because this is the guy that I really want to focus on. Since his divorce, Al had occasionally rented out the basement of his townhome. A few weeks before his murder, he had placed an ad, both in the newspaper and online, looking for a new tenant. A man claiming to be from the East Coast responded and said he was moving to Denver for a job at Wells Fargo Bank, the same bank where the killer later withdrew that $1,000. And Linda actually somewhat crossed paths with this person when he first came to view the home, because about 3 weeks prior to the murder, she had stopped by and Al told her that someone was there to look at the basement. He suggested she come down and meet him, and she agreed, but first she went upstairs to use the bathroom. And by the time she came back, the man was gone, so when Linda asked Al what had happened, he said the man was no longer interested in renting, and at that point, she thought that was the end of it. But it wasn't. On May 18th, the man came back and said he had changed his mind. So he signed the rental agreement, paid Al half the month's rent along with a security deposit, which came to $1,000. Yes, the same amount taken from the ATM. Al also gave him a key to the home, the same key that would later be found in the kitchen sink. But after that, the man never came back. So yes, he had paid. Yes, he had a key, but he never moved in. And Al told Linda that the man had some furniture that wouldn't fit down the stairs, so he was still trying to figure all of that out before he moved in. But overall, the man never spent a night in the home. And while Linda was never able to see the man's face, detectives were able to find a neighbor who may have. That neighbor reported seeing a man with a cane walking into Al's home several days before the murder. He had dark hair, was well-dressed, and appeared to be in his early 50s. And detectives were actually able to locate the rental agreement. It had been thrown away in the trash inside Al's home. Now, on that agreement, the tenant listed his name as Robert Cooper. Also in the trash was a note Al had wrote on a piece of mail, and it had the name Robert and a phone number. But when detectives started digging into that name, shocker, they quickly realized it wasn't real. In fact, every piece of information Cooper provided was false. The social security number belonged to a woman in Indiana, the address was tied to an elementary school in Denver, and the reference phone number traced back to a retirement village in Aurora. So detectives shifted their focus to the phone number, and they learned that the phone Cooper used was a burner phone purchased in March of 2004 at a convenience store about 25 minutes from Al's home. But here's the thing. He waited 31 days to activate it. Why would he do that? Well, it was one day longer than the store kept surveillance footage. So, they didn't have a way to go back and see who actually purchased the phone, but they still had the phone number, so it gave them something to work with. Investigators found that Cooper had used it to contact around 100 people who were renting out properties in the Denver area. And based on that, detectives thought Cooper was hunting for a victim. Detectives were also able to determine that a large number of the calls Cooper made went to people connected to the University of Colorado Hospital. Detectives believed that he may be in that area, possibly looking at housing listings or scouting locations. They also noticed a pattern in how and when those calls were made. All of them happened outside normal working hours, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, which suggested that he may have had a job and he wouldn't be able to make those calls during the day. I would push back on that theory slightly and say that he could have also made those calls outside working hours, assuming that the people he was trying to contact would be more likely to pick up outside those hours. Again, it's all speculative. It's all conjecture. We're entitled to our opinions. I just hate to focus on one particular profile, assuming that this person even had a job in that area. For all we know, he was a transient passing through. And when he did make calls, he was moving between different towns, which investigators believe was intentional to avoid being tracked to a single location. This stood out because it wasn't well known at the time that police could track calls from cell phones. So again, 2004, still relatively new. I wouldn't say he's a genius for being able to figure this out. But again, everything I'm telling you about him waiting 31 days, him moving from location to location, this is not someone who's a first timer. This is someone who has experience. This is someone who's put in the research, the planning. They know what they're doing. If they're not a professional, they're damn near close to it. There was also another detail that stood out that I think is extremely important, and it was in the middle of those 100 calls. There was about a 2 or 3 week period where he didn't make any calls at all, and detectives had wondered if it coincided with something like spring break or a temporary incarceration. I would add to that, maybe he could have been out of town, maybe he was working on another murder, maybe there was something going on within his personal life, maybe a family member where he had to put things on hold, or it could have been something to do with work. I covered the Honolulu Strangler out in Honolulu, Hawaii, and one thing where we, in our opinion, identified the serial killer was the fact that there were periods of time where he would go inactive, and we were able to cross-reference that with his job at the airport, and it lined up on certain occasions. Additionally, there was a period where he didn't commit any murders for multiple years, and what we learned is that when the murder stopped, it coincided with a tragic death of his son, who was involved in a motor vehicle accident. He was on the side of the road changing a tire and was hit by a car. And for a period of time, for about 2 or 3 years, he didn't murder anyone. And once we identified him, we were able to go back and basically create like an overlay to put on the timeline of the murders with a timeline of his whereabouts and what was going on in his life, and it lined up. The same thing might be done here later. I usually say this for the perspective, but I have a lot to cover, so I'll say it now. This piece of information, there's not a ton you can do with it right now. However, if you develop a suspect and you're able to get some information on them during these periods of time, you can then create an overlay and try to match it up with these phone calls. And maybe there will be a pattern. So detectives kept digging into these phone calls, and they learned that out of all the people he contacted, Cooper only met with 3 in person. One of those individuals was a woman who taught Romanian at the University of Denver. She told authorities that when she met him at her property, the hair on the back of her neck stood up. During the visit, he made sexual comments toward her and then left. She didn't see where he went or if he got into a car, and he never contacted her again. But she was able to get a good look at him, and the description she gave matched what detectives had already heard from the neighbor. She also noticed something else. She said Cooper had a slight Romanian accent, and when she asked him about it, he confirmed that he was in fact Romanian. I do have to preface here that if we're dealing with a professional who is meeting with these people in person and he's doing things to alter his appearance, is it possible that he was also altering his accent? Maybe he was specifically trying to talk in a Romanian accent because he felt like it would bring her guard down. It would make him more relatable. They'd have something in common. And so, yeah, he's going to confirm, oh, yeah, I'm Romanian, even though he may be Irish for all we know. So I just want to put that out there. I don't want anyone to take this episode and say, oh, we're clearly looking for a guy who's Romanian, because that may not be the case. That may be exactly what he wants us to do. And part of the reason I say this is because detectives also spoke with other people who had met with Cooper, but their descriptions didn't match the previous ones. They believed he was in his 30s, which conflicted with earlier descriptions of a man in his 50s. This led investigators to believe that he had been intentionally altering his appearance from meeting to meeting, making it difficult for anyone to give a consistent description, which is in line with what I just said, right? It's clearly the same person. They're tracking it back to the same phone number. And this guy's obviously doing things to alter how he looks because he knows what his intentions are. And eventually, law enforcement is going to come knocking and he knows what their tactics are. He knows what they're going to look into. Maybe he's former law enforcement, but for whatever reason, he's taking those measures, those extra steps, so that when they go down those rabbit holes, they lead nowhere. It's all dead ends because he's getting in front of every lead they may potentially develop. I'm telling you, this guy's good. And because of those discrepancies in the description, detectives did the right thing. They worked with all the witnesses to create multiple composite sketches. Unfortunately, it didn't pan out and none of them led to the suspect, and eventually the case went cold. But as I mentioned earlier, DNA would become a factor in this case. We're going to talk about it right after the break. Everybody's talking about weight loss injections right now because the results are so dramatic, at least if you believe everything you see online. And basically, these injections work by lowering blood sugar and reducing appetite. But what if you're looking to lose weight, but you're not interested in painful weekly injections, especially when you hear about some of the side effects that come from using these injections? This is exactly why doctors created a weight loss supplement called Lean, and the results are incredible. The studied ingredients in Lean have shown to lower your blood sugar, burn fat by converting it into energy, and curb your appetite and cravings so you're not as hungry. But listen, and this is very important, Lean is not for the casual dieter who only has a few pounds to lose. The doctors at Brickhouse Nutrition created Lean specifically for frustrated dieters with 10 or more pounds to lose. So if that's you, let's get you started with 20% off and free rush shipping so you can add Lean to your healthy diet and exercise plan. All you have to do is visit takelean.com and enter detective for your discount. That's promo code detective at takelean.com. Listen, we all go through rough patches. Maybe it's a breakup. Maybe it's something at work. Could be burnout or even just that creeping anxiety that doesn't let you sleep at night. And you're laying there thinking, I wish I had someone to talk to who actually gets it. I know I've been there. I've talked to you guys about it before. And I know how powerful therapy can be. Not only for me, but for my friends, for my family, and for the people that are close to me who are really struggling and needed help. But let's be honest, getting access to the right therapist, it could be a nightmare. You call around, people aren't taking new clients, they're not in your network, or it costs a fortune. And that's where Rula comes in. Rula is really changing the game. They make high-quality mental health care accessible and affordable. Most people pay only $15 a session, and they take most major insurance. All you have to do is answer a few quick questions, and you're matched with a licensed professional who meets your preferences, and you can be talking to someone as soon as the next day. Rula has over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists in their network, so finding the right person will not be a problem. And the best part about Rula is they don't just leave you hanging after that. They actually stay with you, checking in on your progress and making sure you're getting what you need out of therapy. Whether it's a therapist or even a psychiatrist to help with medication management, Rula's got you covered. So if you've been thinking about therapy, or even if this is the first time you're considering it, take this as your sign. Thousands of people have already used Rula to finally get the care they needed, so don't keep putting it off. Go to Rula.com/detective and get started today. That's RULA.com/detective. Take the first step, get connected, and take control of your mental health. All right, we're back, and in 2017, investigators turned to new technology in hopes of generating leads. They hired Parabon Nanolabs, a DNA technology company in Virginia that specializes in DNA phenotyping, a process that allows investigators to predict physical appearance and ancestry. And I've talked about this before in other cases, but the first case that I had any experience with phenotyping from Parabon specifically was the case of Faith Hedgepeth, which I covered on Breaking Homicide, and that was a murder out of North Carolina. Really fascinating stuff. You're going to see some images in a few minutes, but what they can do and how they can potentially show you an actual image of the person you're looking for based on DNA, it's pretty cool stuff, and it's only getting better each and every day. Now, using that DNA from Al's case, Parabon created what's called a snapshot profile. This included predictions for ancestry, eye color, hair color, skin tone, freckling, and even face shape. All of that was combined to produce a composite image of what the person of interest may look like at 25 years old. That profile suggested the suspect in Al's case was of Southeast European descent, with fair skin, brown or hazel eyes, brown or black hair, and a few freckles. But investigators knew that the killer would now be older than 25, so they also created an age-progressed version to reflect what he may look like in 2017. But even with all of that, the images did not lead to a suspect. 2 years later, in 2019, retired investigator Paul Holes took a closer look at Al's case for his show, The DNA of Murder, on Oxygen. As part of the show, he worked with intelligence analyst Julie Quinn to look specifically at the binding and torture elements of the case. What was interesting in the show was that Quinn explained there was a form of foot beating called falaka that could have been used on Al. It's used in Turkey both to extract information and to maintain compliance. While a cane or switch is typically used, she noted that the honing rod found in the sink would be comparable to the tools used in that method. She also went on to note that the way Al was tied was, quote, very specifically linked to a militant organization in Turkey known as the Turkish Hezbollah. I do want to note that that group disbanded in the early 2000s and many of its members fled the region. But based on that information, investigators considered the possibility that Robert Cooper may have been one of those individuals. And while Quinn was developing a profile on the suspect based on his actions, Holes also sent off that blood sample from the crime scene and had it analyzed again for ancestry. And the results suggested the suspect's lineage could be tied to the Balkan region, which includes parts of Turkey. Taking all of that together, the DNA, the bindings, the torture, and the reported Romanian accent, Holes speculated that Cooper could have been a member of that Turkish Hezbollah at one point and then immigrated to the United States. His theory was that the offender was no longer able to carry out torture through that organization, so he may have sought out victims on his own, and that Al was simply the person he chose. Detectives working the case have looked into that theory, and as far as I know, they have not been able to rule it out. And it's an interesting theory, and I agree with Paul as far as it being a strong possibility. If everything is as it appears, and you take into consideration Quinn's profile of the suspect, it does seem to align. Now, couple that with the ancestry results, and you may have something. There's no doubt about it. It's also possible that he wasn't a member of this Turkish Hezbollah, but he had a fascination with them. Maybe he was a fan from afar based on his ancestral background. We don't know. He may have not actually been a member of that group, but always wanted to be. And this was his way of carrying out some of the acts that they did when they were together on his own terms in the United States. So I wouldn't say definitively, yeah, if you want to find this guy, you got to find the members of the Turkish Hezbollah, but it's definitely a possibility. And also one more thing that I want to mention that was interesting about the DNA of murder. During an interview with Mike, Al's best friend, who was out with him before he was murdered, I don't know if this is something that was put into his brain and he just thinks he remembers it, or it actually happened, but he told Paul during an interview that's in this episode that Al had actually said to him, not only was he going home to clean up, but he was also going to meet up with his roommate. So just another layer to this that supports the idea that Robert Cooper is the guy we're looking for. In 2019, Oxygen also reported that the Aurora Police Department submitted the blood evidence for genetic genealogy testing. The results were provided to the FBI, who began working to build out possible family trees in the hopes of identifying Robert Cooper. But they weren't able to identify anyone, not even distant relatives, which matched detectives' theory that the suspect may not have even been from the United States. As of today, investigators are still trying to build out a family tree, and as more people submit DNA to databases like GEDmatch, the chances of identifying the suspect continue to increase. Unfortunately, there are no other updates in Al's case. His killer is still out there somewhere, and investigators are on the hunt for the monster only known as Robert Cooper. All right, let's dive into the perspective, and I have to apologize ahead of time. I have a lot to cover. I have like 4 or 5 pages of notes, and normally I can memorize most of it and talk directly to you guys. There's too much here, and I wrote this late at night, so my handwriting's not great. I have reviewed it, but if you see me looking down at my notebook, if you're watching on YouTube, I apologize. That's the reason why. So let's get into theories. I'm going to talk about 3 or 4 of them. There's probably 20 in this case, but I'm going to talk about the ones that are most prominent to me. First off, without going over it again, I think Paul holds his theory here as far as who this individual might be and their former affiliations. Completely possible. No way to dispute that. Even investigators working the case have said it's still a plausible theory. So we have that. We also have the fact that this could be a serial killer, someone who is a transient, who travels throughout the country, has done a good job of not really tying themselves down to anyone. And yeah, they still could be from outside the country, but they're not staying in one location. They're traveling from town to town, state to state. They're identifying soft targets, maybe using similar patterns like buying a burner phone, saying they want to rent an apartment or a house, locating individuals who live alone and maybe are a little bit more friendly and willing to let their guard down, people who see the best in others, and they take advantage of that. And this person may have a fetish with torturing. They may even have a fascination or be a fan of the Turkish Hezbollah, even if they're not an actual member. And they may have practiced or studied the different torture techniques that they would use. And their gratification comes from implementing those techniques on different victims. And so this monster comes into town, spends about a month or two there, makes some phone calls, finds the soft target, eventually goes in, kills their victim, takes as little money as possible and make sure they clean the scene, leave no paper or digital trail, and then they move on to the next state. And so how do we address that? And I think the FBI is probably already doing it. We look for similar patterns in cases throughout the country. Are there similar modus operandi that are happening in different states or different regions of the world where you can potentially identify someone who has a similar description who has carried out similar crimes? I'd like to think if they had, they may announce it at this point, or it could be something where this guy's so good, they have multiple cases, but it's the same story in all the different places. They have a description, he goes by a weird name, and then ultimately when they run the DNA, if there's any DNA, it comes back to no one. The guy's essentially a ghost. The third theory I want to talk about, which I didn't mention at all during the episode, because it seems kind of commonsensical, is the fact that what if this was someone who had an axe to grind specifically with Al, right? What if this is someone who prepared, planned, and had a revenge plot specifically for Al because of something in his past? What that is, I don't know. If I knew, or if investigators knew, maybe we wouldn't be here right now. But is it possible, like with people in your own lives, that you think you know a guy, right? They're a good person, genuinely nice to everybody. Nobody has an issue with them, but there's something going on behind the scenes that you're not aware of. Or maybe it's someone he's tied to, right? He was dating Linda. Did she have some enemies in her past? Did she have some secret admirers that they were unaware of? There's so many possibilities that Al was the victim of a crime because of something that happened years prior, maybe from him or somebody he was associated with. And so I would like to think at this point with everybody involved, those theories have been thoroughly vetted, looking into Linda's past, looking into Mike's past, looking into the family member's past of Al, and also looking into Al directly as well and seeing what's there. Was there anything that could have happened over the past, let's say 5 years, where there might have been somebody out there who, even though they weren't on the surface, there was an anger festering and they were looking for the right time to strike? Now, I saved this theory for one of the last theories because I don't believe that's what happened here, but that's not my job to figure out what happened. My job is to explore all possibilities and make sure that if there's someone from this case listening or watching this episode, they're sitting there as I'm doing this, taking notes going, yeah, dummy, we already did that. That's the answer I want. That's the reaction I hope they're having where they're going, yeah, real smart. It could be somebody connected to him. Like, we haven't looked into that. Of course we did. That's what I'm hoping they're saying, because there's always a possibility they're watching or listening on the other end going, hmm, I didn't think about that. Now, I don't think that's the case here, but I know it's happened in other cases we've covered, and it's concerning. It's not what you want, but it's also the silver lining there is that they can do it now. But that's why I bring it up. I don't want to spend too much time on it. The final theory that I want to talk about, and I haven't heard it mentioned anywhere before, but I think it's something that really needs to be considered. Think about the guy we're talking about so far. Calculated, methodical, strategic, intelligent, right? This person knows what they're doing. A skill set involving disguise and an ability to clean up a crime scene. Maybe the ability to even speak foreign languages. Someone who uses tactics like a burner phone and waits 31 days to activate it. And then makes 100 phone calls on that phone, knowing damn well that law enforcement is going to be able to track that down and look at those phone calls. Knowing the profile that we have on this person who clearly knows what they're doing, probably a professional, wouldn't it be possible that those 100 phone calls and the 3 or 4 visits that he made were all intentional to make it look like Al's murder was random? He just happened to be the one they chose, when in reality, he was the target all along. Let me elaborate. What if there was something in Al's past, something that he had knowledge of? Again, I don't know what that would be, whether it was something in his personal life or maybe a former profession, but something that this person was hired or knew Al had information about. Maybe it was something incriminating. And so they were brought in to attack Al, torture him, extract whatever information they needed, and then kill him. And they deliberately used this phone and made those calls to throw law enforcement off, to make them think that this was some Turkish Hezbollah member who was just looking to carry out acts of torture on unsuspecting victims to fulfill some deep gratification he had when he was part of this group many years ago. Not as crazy as you think when you talk about the measures that this person took to get away with this crime. They were prepared. They knew what they were doing. And some of the behaviors that are displayed by the killer appear to be contradictory. On one hand, they seem like they're squared away, and on the other hand, they made some really rookie mistakes. And you have to ask yourself, were they mistakes or were they intentional? I hope this is something that investigators are listening to right now going, I didn't think about that. That's an interesting angle. Well, what do we do with it? In addition to trying to develop a profile on the suspect, you have to develop a thorough profile on Al. That means going as deep as you can to find out what he was involved in, who he associated with, even if it was many years ago. Did he ever cross anybody? Did he ever witness anything? Was he involved in any type of government activity or political activity? Something where he may have overheard or saw something that there was an individual or a group of people out there that were concerned about. Am I crazy for saying this? Is this conspiracy? Maybe, but when you think about the person who carried out this crime, in my opinion, they're a professional. And so in addition to developing a profile on Al, we also have to look at the suspect, and I'm sure a thorough profile has been developed on him as well, as much as they can, but we also have to keep revisiting the DNA portion of this. We have the blood at the crime scene. We have the hair in the car. We also have the suspect taking a shower and using Al's vehicle, although he was wearing gloves. All of these things, whatever DNA was collected and preserved, technology is constantly changing, right? There's developments in artificial intelligence in conjunction with genealogy and ancestry databases where we're able to make connections that we were never able to make before. And even with small incremental amounts of DNA that were not usable in the past are now being utilized through new processes to develop a profile that can be used to identify the person that owns that DNA. And that's also where you guys can help as well, by submitting your DNA. As I mentioned earlier, there are multiple databases out there like GEDmatch where you can upload your DNA profile and maybe it'll help solve a case. I actually did a live chat where I had the ancestry kit in front of me because one of you asked me about it, and I literally got my results back like 2 days ago. And it's so fascinating. I learned so much about my ancestry, not only where I'm from, but also my potential ancestors. I even learned that I might have a small amount of Native American in me, which makes sense when you think about the settlers coming over here. And although it might not have been under good terms, considering those circumstances, I don't even want to think about it. It does appear that I have Native American in me, which is, I never knew that. It's crazy to think that. So if for no other reason than to learn more about yourself, you also have the ability to help out others and to maybe give some closure to some of these cases. So the more DNA samples that we have specifically from people who are of African American descent or Latino descent, the higher chance we have of identifying these suspects where there's DNA in those cases. And in my opinion, if anything's going to solve this case, that's what it's going to be, the advancements of science and technology around DNA. I always say to you guys, you know, maybe there's someone out there who knows something and just hasn't come forward yet, and that's still a possibility. But in my opinion, based on what we've learned about the suspect, they're not a bragger. They did what they did, and they never talk about it again. They don't need to get validation from someone else. They don't need to vent and clear their mind or their conscience because of what they did. They have no moral compass. This was a transactional event. They went in, they did what they did, they got out, and they moved on and probably never spoke about it to anyone. But just to make sure we're covering our bases, I want to recap in case there is somebody out there. So just to recap, on May 22nd, 2004, 53-year-old Oki Albert Kite Jr. was killed inside his townhome in Aurora, Colorado after being bound and tortured for hours. The killer cleaned the scene, removed key evidence, and used Al's debit card to withdraw $1,000 before abandoning his truck nearby. DNA was recovered, but it has never been matched to anyone. Investigators identified a man using the name Robert Cooper, who had recently gained access to Al's home using false information. But more than 20 years later, Cooper has never been identified. Anyone with information in Al's case is asked to call the Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867, or you can call your local FBI office. There is a $2,000 reward for information. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Al. I know you guys are hurting, and I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. In some of these cases, there's a silver lining where you can say, oh, at least they didn't suffer, or it was quick. We know that's not the case here. And unfortunately, there's nothing that I or anybody can do to change that. All we can do is continue to fight and not give up hope and try to find the person responsible for what happened to Al. Not only for him, not only for you, but for everybody. Because as long as there's a person like this out there capable of doing what they did to Al, nobody's safe. We need to find this person as soon as possible and make sure they never hurt anybody again. And I really do hope that one day I get the opportunity to sit right here and let all of you know that that's exactly what happened. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.